I'm Midday producer Rob Sivak, and this is the Midday News Wrap. Today, a rundown of the stories making news in our region. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam continues to defy calls for his resignation after photos of him in blackface surfaced last week, a further blackface admission from Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring, and a sexual assault allegation against Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax has left Richmond reeling in political turmoil. Robert McCartney from The Washington Post joins us with the latest from Virginia. Baltimore County has announced a nationwide search for a permanent school superintendent, and county teachers express their concern over budget cuts to the school board. WYPR reporter John Lee brings us up to date on those developments. Plus, Sun reporter Ian Duncan joins us with the latest from City Hall. Guest host Nathan Sterner is in for Tom Hall when Midday gets underway right after these headlines.
Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. Today, the Midday News Wrap. New Orleans Police Superintendent Michael Harrison, or former New Orleans Police Superintendent Michael Harrison, rather, is set to become Baltimore City Police Commissioner Monday of next week in an acting capacity. If the City Council approves his nomination, Harrison would become the city's fifth police commissioner in 4 years. Later this hour, we'll be talking with Baltimore Sun reporter Ian Duncan about that. Also later this hour, we'll be talking with WYPR reporter John Lee about the latest developments from Baltimore County, including the recently announced nationwide search for a permanent school superintendent. But this week's News Wrap will start with a focus on Virginia, where pressure continues to mount on that state's political leadership as two blackface scandals and an allegation of sexual assault have plunged the governor's office into turmoil. Robert McCartney is the senior regional correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us on the line from Washington to talk about this. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Nathan.
It was just 1 week ago that the public saw the racist photograph that was on Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's medical school yearbook page, a picture showing two men, one in blackface, the other dressed in a Ku Klux Klan hood and robes. Initially, Northam apologized for that and said it was him, but the next day he walked that back. Tell us how this all got started, Robert.
Well, as you said, it emerged late Friday, a week ago, that this photo was there on his yearbook page. Very offensive, racist photo, man in blackface, somebody in a hood, Ku Klux Klan hood. And he initially said that it was, apologized profusely. This is Democrat Ralph Northam. He apologized profusely and said it was he was in one of the people in the photo. Then the next day, he walked it back and said he was mistaken when he said that initially. He wasn't in the photo. He had only seen the photo for the first time, and in fact, the yearbook for the first time, on Friday, late Friday, when a conservative website put it out, found it and put it out. So he said that it wasn't him in the photo, and he had no idea how that photo had gotten on his page. But he also, it was a very awkward press conference, widely panned as a particularly bad performance. He did say that he had put on blackface to imitate Michael Jackson and win a contest imitating Michael Jackson the same year. This all happened in 1984, so 35 years ago was when this medical school yearbook came out. He admitted that, and then there's also this question about he was called, one of his nicknames, according to his undergraduate college yearbook at Virginia Military Institute, said one of his two nicknames was Coon Man. Coon, of course, is a derogatory term for an African-American. And he had no explanation for why he was called Coon Man. He said a couple of upperclassmen called him that, didn't know why.
Has any explanation for that come out, those upperclassmen who called him that? Has anyone been able to get comment from that? That's such a, weird.
None to my knowledge. In fact, it's considering it's been a week now, we don't know why he was called Coon Man. We know that he put on blackface to win the Michael Jackson dance competition where he moonwalked successfully, apparently. And we still don't know who are the two people in the photograph or how that photograph came to be on his page. there's still a lot to find out here. Now, people who were involved in editing the medical school yearbook have said that the photos on people's pages were submitted by the individuals. So that would imply that he not only had seen the photo, but he actually submitted it to be included on the page. But other people said that some photos got added or people's photos got mixed up a little and in the process of editing it and laying out the yearbook. So that's still fuzzy. And he says for sure, and actually some of his classmates from medical school have said they're sure that he isn't one of the people in the photo. But we still don't know who is in the photo or, as I said, how that photo came to be on his page.
The calls for Northam's resignation started coming a week ago on Friday as the photo came out, and they've only seemed to grow from there. Is there anyone not calling for his resignation?
Well, the entire Democratic establishment, all of the, but both senators, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, have called for it. All the congressional the Democrats in Congress have called for it. There are some people. Joe Lieberman, the former U.S. senator and vice presidential candidate with Al Gore in 2000, has said he shouldn't have to resign until we know more. Former congressman, Democratic congressman from Arlington, Jim Moran, has said, look, we should judge him by his record since 1984, which has been positive for at least in recent years, which is all I know about his career, and since he became lieutenant governor. His reputation since, you know, in recent years in public office has been very positive towards African Americans. So there are at least a couple of people. I guess Mudcat Saunders, who's a Democratic strategist in Southern Virginia, very outspoken fellow, he's said he shouldn't have to resign. So there are a few, but overwhelmingly, the entire Democratic congressional delegation, two senators and seven Congress people, all reiterated in a statement yesterday that he should resign.
But since his press conference on Saturday of last week, he's not really been saying much, and it would be very difficult to make him resign if he doesn't want to, wouldn't it?
That's correct. He has said that he doesn't want to resign. He said that he doesn't want to go out, basically, in a way where he would forever be remembered as a racist. He has kept a very low profile since then. He has been doing some work. He signed a bill, a law, to give Amazon huge subsidies to put 25,000 workers in Arlington, the HQ2 proposal. He has negotiated a deal, a fairly significant tax cut deal, with the Republican-controlled legislature that just happened in the last 48 hours. So he has been doing some work, but he's hired a PR firm, an African-American-led PR firm, to sort of help him manage this crisis. He has hired a private investigator to try to get to the bottom of who's in that photo and how did that photo come to be on his page. He's reached out to other privately to Democrats and some other people and talked to them about how he's going to try to get out of that. It is very hard to impeach him. There is a provision for it, but the criteria for impeachment and removal from office under the Virginia Constitution doesn't really include, you know, having a racist photo published in your yearbook 35 years ago. I mean, the criteria for impeachment is crimes or incapacity to do the job or some things like that, similar to what's in the U.S. Constitution. So it's hard to sort of square that. Even the Republican leaders in the legislature have said it would be hard to justify impeaching him under the language of the impeachment clause.
And Northam is not the only top Virginia official facing a blackface scandal. Wednesday, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring admitted that he had also worn blackface when he was younger.
Right. He was 19 when he did it. He was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia, and he wore blackface to imitate a rapper, similar to how Northam did it to imitate Michael Jackson. He apologized. He came forward. This was not discovered regarding the Attorney General Mark Herring. He came forth and acknowledged it. But he's in a very tough situation because he had called for Northam's resignation over the photo, and then he had to come out and say, "Oh well, I did it too." So he's very embarrassed.
It does.
And then, of course, the Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who would become governor if Northam resigned. Justin Fairfax has his own sexual scandal. A woman has accused him of assaulting her, sexual assault, in 1984.
And that's an issue where this had been something that she had alleged earlier to the Washington Post, and the Post investigated but wasn't able to substantiate. Not saying it didn't happen, just saying they couldn't find that it did or didn't.
That's correct. The Washington Post, one of my colleagues, looked into this allegation last year, looked into it quite thoroughly, and it was basically a he said, she said situation where she said that Fairfax had assaulted her at the Democratic National Convention in Boston in 2004, and he said it was a consensual encounter, and we could find no corroboration for either person's account. So we did not do a story. My boss, the executive editor, Marty Baron, has issued a statement saying we did not do a story because we could not corroborate it. We don't know whom to believe. We couldn't find any substantiation for either account.
What reactions are the problems facing Herring and Fairfax getting? It has not been as swift or as unanimous in the calls for resignation against those two as it has against Governor Northam.
That's correct. There have not been widespread calls, especially in the Democratic Party, and especially from the Black Legislative Caucus, which is playing a very influential role here, for either the Lieutenant Governor Fairfax or the Attorney General Herring to step down. Basically, people are saying we need to do a more thorough investigation of what's going of Fairfax's the claims against Fairfax. And this is got all complicated because, of course, a lot of Democrats said that Justice Kavanaugh should not be elevated to the Supreme Court because they believed the woman who accused him of sexual assault. So if the Democrats believed her, then why don't they believe this woman who's now accusing Fairfax? So people are basically saying there should be more investigation of that. And then with Herring, I think because he was younger, because he came forth and volunteered it, the people are basically saying, well, let's see how he deals with this going forward and what sorts of things he says. And the people are sort of giving him a much longer leash than they have with Northam.
But is that all of the reason that they are giving Herring a longer leash? If Northam were to have stepped down, say, Saturday of last week, Fairfax would have become governor. But now that Fairfax is facing the allegations of sexual assault, and now that there's the blackface scandal involving Herring, if Herring were to go, the Democrats would lose control of the governor's mansion in Virginia.
No, if Herring, you mean if both,
if
all
three
of them had to resign.
Right.
Yeah, if all three of them had to resign, then the next person in line is the Speaker of the House, who is a Republican, Kirk Cox. But it's more complicated than that because everybody's been trying to figure out how this works. But first of all, I think it's very unlikely that all three of them would resign, partly because I just don't think the people have the appetite for that. And as you said, the Democrats don't want to see all three go and have the Republican take over the governor's mansion. I mean, there's that partisan political concern for the Democrats as well. But there's another twist here, and that is that if the governor steps down and the lieutenant governor is elevated, then the new governor gets to appoint a new lieutenant governor.
Ah.
So the and then that person then has to run for office, run for to be sustained in office at the next election, which would be in November. So in theory, Fairfax could be elevated to the governorship, appoint a lieutenant governor, you know, and then it's, I don't know what exactly would happen. If he stepped down, if the lieutenant governor would become governor and then have to face election, that's still all kind of murky. But it's the line of succession is not as clear-cut because you can appoint a new lieutenant governor once you're elevated.
So it could be an incredibly complicated musical chairs game should a resignation by
correct.
Northam occur.
That's correct. Yeah, I think there's a very good chance if Northam... Well, the question is Northam going to resign? Is Northam going
to be... What's the answer to that question?
And if he is, then we're going to have a huge legal and political mess, basically.
Is there any indication that Northam is going to resign?
Well... Not so far. He's unwilling to, but the entire Democratic establishment has reiterated as recently as yesterday that they want him to resign. It will be very hard for him to be an effective governor without their support. The word is right now that partly because these other scandals have so diluted the attention being paid to Northam that he's actually seen some relief in the pressure on him. And then also, they're in the middle of the session, the legislative session, which is very short in Virginia. It's scheduled to end 2 weeks from tomorrow. And the word is now, the Democrats are saying privately, they expect Northam at least to last until the end of the legislative session. So that's 2 weeks and a day. Now, I think that if anything else comes out to prove that either he's in that photo or he had anything to do with that photo being on his page, then I think that would be it, that he would know he had to resign because he's not only did it, but he also has been lying about it, and then he would have to go. But if he can last the 2 weeks, and if it is somehow determined that he's not in the photo and he had nothing to do with it, and he, you know, makes the apologies and reaches out to people, and given how hard it is to impeach him, I think he could survive.
Of course, as you mentioned, the legislative session in Virginia is continuing for another 2 weeks. And earlier this week, there was the Amazon subsidy that Governor Northam signed there. You broke some news just moments ago about Amazon. Tell us what's going on.
Right. Yeah, we just had a story. Myself and my colleagues, Jonathan O'Connell and Patricia Sullivan, just broke a big story that the new Amazon is considering pulling out of the New York deal to put 25,000 jobs in Queens because of the local opposition from local politicians is so strong. Now, this is according to two unidentified people familiar with the company's plan. So this is a couple of anonymous sources. But it's been going this way. There's very, very strong opposition in New York at the grassroots level to the Amazon plan, and especially to the plan to pay, well, about up to $3 billion in state and local subsidies for these jobs. And a lot of the politicians, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose district, the freshman, very well-known freshman, very liberal legislator, congresswoman, her district is right next to where the Amazon site would be. And in her neighborhood, in her area, there's a lot of popular opposition to Amazon and over concerns over gentrification. They also don't like Amazon. There are a lot of immigrants in the neighborhood, and they don't like Amazon because it has contracts with companies that work with federal immigration authorities. They don't like that. And they're just concerned about housing prices and congestion and inequality in being exacerbated in New York. And a lot of local politicians are fighting that, and they have some leverage. And basically, Amazon's concerned that this fight is not worth the candle, and they are thinking of pulling out. So this is by no means a done deal, but there's a real risk that could happen, I think.
And while there are concerns about housing and equality in Virginia with its half of the Amazon headquarters, the subsidies there, they're going into place.
Yeah, no, the Northam has already signed the bill to approve the state subsidies. That's already law. The local subsidies, which are much smaller, still have to be approved, but the Arlington County Board, all five members say that they're supporting it. They may want a few more concessions from Amazon. But no, the welcome in Virginia has been pretty strong and is in very stark contrast with the local opposition in New York. Now, I should say that the opinion polls in New York show that there's a lot of support for Amazon going there, and both the governor, Andrew Cuomo, and the mayor, Bill de Blasio, see this as winning Amazon in, for New York as one of the greatest economic development triumphs of all time, and they're still pushing for it hard. But there's a lead, the state Senate, which is a Democratic-controlled state Senate, is very skeptical, and there's some very powerful people on the New York City Council who are very skeptical, plus Ocasio-Cortez, who is a rock star in liberal circles in New York right now. So there's enough opposition that even if they're in a minority, the opponents could well be able to block this, and they certainly can make life miserable enough for Amazon that it says, hey, we got lots of other places who want us. We'll go someplace where we're going to be better received.
Well, this is a developing story, and I'm sure you will continue to cover it. Robert McCartney is senior regional correspondent for The Washington Post, on the line with us from Washington. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Midday News Wrap continues after a quick break. Stay with us here on WYPR. And you are listening to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall. Coming up Monday of next week, the latest installment of Midday on Higher Education, a series of conversations with local college presidents. The Reverend Brian Linane, Jesuit priest and president of Loyola University of Maryland, will join Tom in Studio A for conversation about youth participation in the church and Catholic liberal arts education. That is coming up on Monday. If you are just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap, and we turn our focus now to Baltimore County, the area of WYPR reporter John Lee's expertise. John is with us in Studio A. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So Baltimore County has had a top AAA bond rating for, if not forever, it seems like forever at this point. Tax rates in the county have remained steady for years. Mm-hmm. But last month, new county executive Johnny Olszewski warned that the county is in dire financial straits. Am I not overselling that?
You are not overselling it. He is saying just that. He took over in December. And since then, he has been holding a series of town hall meetings throughout the county. He's had, I believe, five so far, two more to go next week. And been to a couple of them, and he is painting a picture of a county that has some real budget issues, running an $80 million plus shortfall this coming year. And that's a shortfall, not adding any more new money for new programs at current spending levels. So he has been painting a picture, and my sense of it is laying the table for the county that some tough decisions are going to be made, and it's going to happen in the next month or two because he presents his budget in April. And so the best guess right now, he's not saying anything yet, but the best guess right now from talking to people is that we're going to see a combination of budget cuts and most likely a tax increase of some sort when he presents his budget in April. Again, that's not official. That's just the sense that's out there.
This sort of financial situation that the county appears to be in now, it didn't appear to be what was being talked about during the campaign for county executive just last year. How did we get from there to here? Things seemed so rosy the way that the candidates were talking about it.
Well, you know how it goes. When you're out there campaigning, you make a lot of promises. And the county executive, he made a lot of promises last year. He talked about building new schools, spending $1 billion plus on school construction, pay raises for teachers, all kinds of other things, too. And the other candidates did, too. You're right. But now that he's been elected and he's in office and he's looking at the numbers, he's dialing that back quite a bit. He'll tell you he wants to do those things, but the reality is that right now he can't.
What happened?
Well, the sense of it is that the previous county executive, Kevin Kamenetz, he was in office for nearly almost 8 years before his death last year. He embarked on a very, very aggressive school construction program, built about $1.6 billion. And you talk to people in the county, it's desperately needed. The schools were falling apart. They needed to be renovated or replaced. Problem is, that's a lot of money, and as they say, the bill is coming due now. A lot of money was borrowed. I have to pay that off at some points, happening now. So there are other issues, too, involving the county's retirement other things. But that's the big driver, was Kamenetz's school construction program.
Of course, Kamenetz wanted school construction, but so did leaders at the top of the state. Governor Hogan, Comptroller Peter Franchot frequently called Kamenetz to task for not doing enough on school construction.
Yeah, that's right. And Kamenetz pretty much ignored them, even though you could make an argument that the push from the governor and the comptroller also pushed Kamenetz to do it faster. So that, too, may be a factor in all this.
And current County Executive Olszewski is asking for more school construction funds from the state, right?
He is. He went down to Annapolis and said he had just one ask. You know, sometimes the county executive usually goes every year and has a series of things. His one ask was, how about $100 million a year for school construction for the next 5 years? Because what he says is that, you know, if you can get a combination of things together, like if you can get more money from the state, and he's really counting on his years in the legislature, he was in the House of Delegates. He's counting on those friendships that he has down there to bring more money back to the county. And if he can do that, that would go a long way. Nathan, you'll remember that during the campaign, everybody, and I do mean everybody who is running for county executive, promised to build those three high schools, Lansdowne, Towson, and Delaney, new high schools. Truth is, a new high school costs between $125 and $150 million. That's a lot of money. And so Olszewski rather dramatically went before the school board a few weeks ago. That doesn't happen very often in the county. No one could remember the last time, if ever, that had happened. And to give the county school board a reality check about where we are financially, where the county is financially. And what he was saying then is that the reality about those three high schools is that those doors won't open for those new high schools until 2030, unless you start getting some money from somewhere, like from the state, or, you know, maybe a tax increase.
Maybe. So when the county executive went to the school board, which, again, something that does not happen, he asked them to try to find some trimming to the budget, find some way to have the budget to be smaller. And had interim superintendent already... Verlita White already submitted her first budget by that point?
She had submitted her first budget.
Then
came the second. Tale of two budgets. You have the first budget. That's like an 11% increase over last year's spending. There is more positions in there, pay raises for teachers, that kind of thing. And then she got a message from both the Olszewski administration and from the chair and vice chair of the board that you need to dial that back in these times. So she did. She presented a budget that's less than 1% growth. However, the interim superintendent has made it very clear that she stands by the first budget, the 11% budget. And so what you have unfolding now, and it is happening right now, there's going to be a public hearing next week, and then the school board is going to vote on this budget in less than 2 weeks. You have this debate that's going on. Which budget does the school board get behind? Does the school board decide, okay, the county executive is saying we really need to dial it back, let's dial it back? Or do you say, no, what the students and teachers of Baltimore County need is this first budget, and we send that to the county executive and put it on his plate, pretty much dare him to cut it? And so this past week at the school board, there were a lot of people saying, send the county executive the budget that the schools need, and pretty much say, if you got to raise taxes, you got to raise taxes.
One of the differences between the first budget and the second, the 11% versus the 1%, was pay raises for teachers.
Right.
Pay raises are off the table in the second budget.
That's right. And so you had several hundred teachers and their supporters show up at this meeting this past week to complain about that. Now, the other side of this, as always, there's another side. People are saying, look, yes, we have to cut back on the spending. It doesn't have to be on the backs of the teachers. Why don't we find cuts somewhere else? And one of the favorite targets for that is the STAT program, which is the program to put devices in the hands of every student in Baltimore County. Very expensive, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent. There have been some.
Wasn't there some study showing that it's not really seeing a major increase in outcomes?
Yes, but then the interim superintendent White says it's not about just that; that it's also about equity. That you have students in the county who don't have these types of devices and they need to have them. So she made a very passionate defense of this STAT program, also saying that it's woven at this point into the curriculum, and to toss it would also cost a lot of money. They'd have to almost go back to square one. So it's a really, really fascinating battle that's going on right now. And again, we're going to find out in the next week or two how it's going to play out. And Nathan, it's important to remember too that the way that the county is set up is that, yes, the school board is going to pass a budget at some point, but that's just the beginning, because in the end, the county executive makes the decision. The county executive, Olszewski, could add to that budget. He could subtract from that budget.
And this is a whole new school board, a whole new kind of school board than the county has seen in ever.
It is. And so that makes the guesswork harder. I mean, I don't think anybody can even make a best guess on where it's going. What you have is a hybrid elected school board. There are 12 members. 7 of them were elected in November, the others appointed. Only 3 members are left from the previous school board. So how it's going to play out is truly anybody's guess.
Are you seeing a change in dynamic there already?
I think they're still figuring it out. Yeah, I've seen a little bit of it. The current chair and vice chair were on the previous board, and they were also 2 of the members who actually were opposed to interim superintendent White being given the permanent position. And so how that's all going to unfold as far as Ms. White is concerned is also interesting. Hard to figure out where the board's going to go, because they have decided to launch a nationwide search. They did that. They hired the firm just this week.
For a price tag of $100,000?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And they have a fairly short amount of time to do that. You know, usually you start a superintendent search like in the fall to have somebody in place. Both need to be in place by July 1st. They're just starting now. They've just got a few months. And so, and interim superintendent White has made it clear all along she wants the job permanently. But to get a read right now on how the school board feels about her, I really can't. I don't know anyone who can. The previous board, Nathan, you'll recall, voted a couple of times to hire her permanently. It was an 8-4 vote back then. And then, of course, the state school superintendent stepped in and denied her the permanent position.
And this was the reason she was denied the permanent position was a lot about scrutiny over the way her predecessor had run contracts. It sort of spilled over to her.
It did. And she had some ethics violations as well, as far as
Not the reporting. Type of ethics violations that you would put in jail, though.
No,
as her predecessor was facing.
Her predecessor was actually charged with crimes. She never was. And she said that it was an honest mistake. And she has cleared that up, and she's actually promised never to do any sort of outside consulting work again. And so her supporters say that's enough. She's a longtime 20-year-plus veteran of the school system, homegrown supporter. But the other side says, you know, we need to start fresh.
Well, let's say that this new board decides to stay with Acting Superintendent White. Mm-hmm. As you said, last time her nomination was killed by the state school superintendent. Mm-hmm. Could that happen again?
You know, it certainly could happen again. There is legislation out there that would sort of defang the school superintendent. She would only be able to reject a local superintendent if they didn't meet basic qualifications. And Verlita White certainly meets those. That's a timing thing, though. Number one, it has to pass the legislature. Number two, we're talking about they need to have somebody in place by July 1. However, another angle to all this, Nathan, one of the reasons the state school superintendent said that she would not be able to accept Ms. White is because there's been an audit out there of procurement. We had an indication a couple of weeks ago that a draft of that audit is ready. The actual audit itself, I'm thinking, is going to be released soon, the next week or two or so. And so once that happens, that's one of the reasons that the state superintendent said she could not go along with Ms. White. Depending on what that audit shows, that might tell the tale.
And we've been talking a lot about education funding for Baltimore County, but with the county facing dire financial straits, mm-hmm. there are all sorts of other things that could occur as we move forward. We got an email from Matt in Catonsville saying, with such a large budget shortfall in the county, can we consider modest county-level taxes on alcohol or adult entertainment before we consider raising property or income taxes? A nickel a drink tax could go a long way to pay for school construction. We have a handful of adult entertainment venues that could lead to a significant revenue increase. There are specific taxes on these items in other counties, Matt says.
That's interesting. I have not heard that brought up, but it's worth looking into. I will say this, though, which is that actually I had a story on this morning about the they're looking at developer impact fees in the county. They currently cannot put impact fees on developers in Baltimore County. Legislation in the General Assembly right now would give the county the okay to do that. And there's some debate over how much money that would actually raise. But basically what it does is that a developer brings in a big development that's going to put demands on like the schools and the roads in that area. So the developer would have to pay a fee to help pay for that kind of stuff. And so the thinking is that that's another source of money maybe for the county. But there's some concern that the developable land in Baltimore County, a lot of it's already gone. So it's some question as to how much money this would actually raise.
What are you hearing? What do you think is likely in terms of tax increases, assuming there's a tax increase?
The best guess out there right now, and I just want to keep saying it's a guess.
It's a guess. We don't know.
County Executive Oshesky has not pulled me in and said, John, this is what I'm going to do. He has not done that. But there seems to be some talk about perhaps there'll be an income tax increase. And you can look at the political calculation here that if you're going to do it, if you got to do it your first year when you're in office. Because that gives you a few years
to live it down.
Right. Or no, get the balance, get the budget in good place. You know, it's several years back before you have to run for re-election or maybe run for some other office. And so put some distance between you and any sort of a tax increase.
When will we find out?
The county executive goes before the county council in April. I want to say April 15th. Tax day, everybody, but it's certainly in mid-April, and he will present his budget then. So if he hasn't told us before then, we will definitely know then.
John Lee covers Baltimore County for WYPR. Thank you for sitting in this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Quick break here. When we return, the news wrap continues with Baltimore Sun reporter Ian Duncan. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay with us. You are listening to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall this afternoon. Michael Harrison is set to take the helm of the Baltimore City Police Department starting this coming Monday, February 11th. Harrison will be introducing himself to city residents in a series of public meetings starting on Monday and continuing through Friday, February 22nd, meetings that will take place in each of Baltimore's 9 police districts. You can find a link to an article by Baltimore Sun reporter Jessica Anderson, which includes the dates and locations of all of these meetings on the Midday webpage. Joining us now for more on Harrison from the Baltimore Sun newsroom is City Hall reporter Ian Duncan. Ian, so good to have you here.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Good.
And let's start this conversation stipulating that Harrison does appear particularly qualified for the job of police commissioner, significant experience in a large high-crime city to a degree that most other potential candidates just wouldn't be. A little quick background on him?
Yeah, that's right. So he spent his whole career as a police officer in New Orleans, which is slightly smaller than Baltimore, but has similar problems of serious levels of violent crime. Notably, has been going through a federal consent decree that requires civil rights reforms. They're sort of at the later stages of that, while Baltimore is still at the beginning. And that's the kind of two pieces of experience that the mayor's team is really selling him on having. We looked at his record of bringing down violent crime when he was in office, and it's not all the numbers moved in the right direction, but he can point to initiatives on robberies and some positive numbers on homicides last year that he says he's been able to make a real impact down there.
Harrison has only recently been nominated. Well, not nominated. That's how technically hasn't happened yet. Has only recently been designated to be Baltimore Police Commissioner. The previous designee Joel Fitzgerald, back in November, before he dropped out, Mayor Catherine Pugh said that she was thinking of the salary of $260,000 for him annually. Well, this week, the city's Board of Estimates approved a salary for Harrison, bigger, $275,000 a year. And even though Harrison hasn't been formally nominated for the job, this salary is essentially, it's some of it's going to him. He's going to get paid at this point, no matter what.
Right. There was an unusual, I think, clause in the contract that says, if the city council, which have to kind of confirm him to the job, votes him down for whatever reason, that's a power that they have, that he will be guaranteed a year's salary. We don't know why that was included, although I think, you know, it's easy to imagine if someone is being asked to pick up their life and move, that they might have asked for some kind of protection like that. But some people on the city council feel like that's kind of undermining their ability to really kind of judge him, because they're going to know that a no vote comes with this price tag.
What are you hearing from city council members about that?
Yeah, I heard from a couple of people on Wednesday when we saw this contract that they really did feel like it sort of undermined the integrity of the process. You know, the council is trying to make very clear that they want to be very thorough in how they vet this candidate. They were very thorough with Mr. Fitzgerald as well. I think they feel like this puts pressure on them to say yes. On the other hand, you know, it was clear quite early on that there were concerns about whether Fitzgerald was the right person for the job. There don't seem to be those kinds of concerns surrounding Mr. Harrison, and Councilman Mary Pat Clark told one of my colleagues, look, it's kind of a moot point because there's every indication that he's going to be confirmed at this point.
In addition to a higher salary than previous Baltimore police commissioners, the package that the Board of Estimates approved Wednesday has a bunch of other benefits that previous commissioners had not had.
That's right. So he gets a kind of a housing allowance until he sells his house down in New Orleans, or until a year has passed. That's something that the last commissioner who we had, who was kind of traveling across the country, was Anthony Batts. He didn't have a provision like that. He just got sort of basic moving expenses. Mr. Harrison is being given a kind of slightly different deal with his raises. He's guaranteed at least 3% a year, no matter what happens. There's the potential for him to get larger raises kind of tied to his performance. Some of that is going to be objective about crime numbers and the mess, just the recruitment numbers as well. Then that sort of squishier thing about personal leadership. So yeah, the contract will get increasingly valuable as he goes along.
And there's also a completely different deal for severance if he's fired without cause.
That's right. So the last three commissioners had these lump sum arrangements. He will be paid out the kind of balance of the five-year contract if he's removed without cause, which, you know, depending on when that happened, that could potentially be a lot more valuable of a deal. At the same time, the contract also kind of expands the grounds that the mayor can remove him with cause and avoid having to make that payout. And
what are those new grounds?
Yeah, it's quite broad. I mean, there's one that sort of says anything he does that harms the reputation of the Baltimore Police Department, which you can see the city's lawyers being able to argue.
Oh, that's really nebulous, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a kind of personal morality thing. So if he did do something that wasn't a crime or even a violation of the rule, but sort of is unseemly, I guess they could use that as grounds. So it does seem to give the mayor a bit more flexibility. You know, we haven't had a commissioner for a long time who's served out their full term.
No, Not at all. Now, he comes to a police department that is having some significant problems with retaining officers. In a story you published yesterday, you note that the department hired 184 officers last year, while at the same time 220 officers left. Getting people to serve on the force is going to be a big challenge for Harrison, assuming he gets the job.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that the mayor has tried to make a priority, getting more people into the department. They put money in the budget sort of to raise the total number of officers. It was questionable at the time whether they were really going to be able to grow the size of the force by all the 100 that were budgeted. And what we see is they actually lost 36 last calendar year. There seems to be a number of reasons for that, but big one is that they just have this bottleneck of all these applicants coming in, some reforms they've made to the application system, and they can't process them fast enough. A really significant problem that they have is that they can only get about 200 officers a year through the training academy, which makes it difficult to
Is that a logistical, they just can't possibly move more, or is that just all they've been able to do?
No, that seems to be the capacity that they have. And so the mayor is exploring working with Coppin State University and the University of Baltimore to kind of grow that capacity. And it seems like, you know, if they're going to do anything more than just sort of hold steady, they're going to need to find a way to be able to just put more officers through training.
What is the police department doing as it faces this shortage? What tactics is it employing to continue to deal with the issues that the city faces crime-wise?
So a big change that just went into effect this week was this new patrol schedule that they agreed with the union. So previously, officers who were on patrol units worked 10 hours a day, 4 days a week. They kind of have shuffled that around so that they will work 8.5-hour shifts 5 days a week, and then they get like a 2-day weekend 1 week and a 3-day weekend the next week. And the police department's commanders say that gives them more flexibility. They can stretch the number of officers that they have further, and so that should help keep up the strength on the streets. To hear the police commissioner tell it, the acting commissioner, Gary Tuggle, yesterday, they're really kind of, he said, robbing Peter to pay Paul. They're pulling officers out of one unit to put them in another to fill the holes. And so we heard this week from the chief of detectives saying, I don't have enough detectives to investigate homicides and shootings and robberies, you know, the most serious kinds of crimes. And I just lost a detective to go to the recruitment unit. Well, the recruitment unit says it's also understaffed and they need those people, because if you can't recruit people and hire them, then you can never get out from under it. So you get a sense of them just sort of moving pieces around and trying to kind of plug gaps as they come.
Of course, the city police department has a perennial problem with overtime budgets that go super high. Is there any indication that's going to be fixed anytime soon?
So this new schedule, the city's finance department is estimating that will save about $100,000 a week in overtime costs, which sounds like a lot, but it translates to about $5 million a year, and they spend about more than $45 million a year on overtime a year. So it's going to make a dent, but it certainly isn't going to cure the problem. You know, when they were talking about the benefits of this new patrol schedule at a city council hearing this week, one of the commanders was saying, we're still short, though, so that means they're still going to have to rely on overtime to feel the kind of minimum strength that they feel they need on the streets every day.
And that is going to be an issue that Harrison will have to deal with should he become Baltimore Police Commissioner. Ian Duncan covers City Hall for the Baltimore Sun. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
And the first hearing, public hearing, with Commissioner-designate, soon-to-be Commissioner nominee Harrison will be taking place Monday next week at 7 p.m. at Forest Park High School. at 3701 El Dorado Avenue. That's it for Midday today. Coming up Monday, the latest installment in our Midday on Higher Education series, a conversation with the Reverend Brian Linane of Loyola University of Maryland. Our thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-inspired bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses, inspired by traditions of bagel making that date back to the 1940s, available at the Waverly Farmers Market and at bottomsupbagels.com. Midday's director and engineers Luke Spicknell, Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produced the program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote our theme. I'm Nathan Sterner. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.